Question number 12707, Captain Frank Brewis, reel 15.
Captain HCF Brewis, reel 15. Were there any problems, Captain Brewis, with this searchlight tank?
Well, first of all, we had to get used to handling a new type of tank, and of course the Matilda was diesel. And one thing that occurred to me since the last tape, talking about the Matildas, I may have got it wrong. I talked about the power for the arc light. And I think I said that there was a separate generator. In actual fact, on the Matilda, it was run from the tank zone electrical system. It was in the grants that we got later on, where there was much more room, where there was a separate generator to produce the necessary juice. Coming back to your question, the drivers particularly, the fitters, everybody, the gunners, the tank commanders, had to start again from scratch. Entirely new tank, different handling characteristics, much smaller, a bit more difficult to handle than the Churchill. So those were the sort of ground level things that had to be overcome at the start. The training in the use of the CDL equipment, of course, was carried on at the CDL school, which was an independent training unit based up at Lowther Castle. And I can't remember offhand what the sort of intake for each course was. It was fairly limited by the time I got round to it, but I was one of the tail end Charlies. I was, as usual, flitting about between the regimental headquarters, where I was doubling as assistant adjutant, intelligence officer, liaison officer, and a fair bit of time spent with the scout car troop. So the front line bods in the squadrons had first whack, and as I say, I was one of the tail end Charlies, and there weren't all that many on the course that I remember. Probably not more than a dozen of us. I think they were scraping the bottom of the barrel then. The training was done in a limited part of a much larger training area, which lay, basically between Lowther and the Lowther Castle grounds and the village of Ascombe, between there and getting on towards the land on the east side of Ullswater. I've mentioned security about the Blue Camp military police, censorship of police, the tarpaulins over the turrets, which looked extraordinary with no gun in evidence. And a good deal of this training area was on an upslope from the farmland area nearest Lowther Camp, so that dependent on where exercises were carried out, they could be north-south across the training area, or east-west, but when they were from the south to the north on gradually rising ground, everybody in the area could see these great fans of light overlapping and moving up the hillside.
Did you ever hear what the civilians thought of these glows in the sky? Did it ever come back to you, fed back to you?
No. We were so strictly warned that there had to be no discussion of it at all, and if it was mentioned, then we had to skirt round it without saying anything. From the major aspect of security, I'm trying to remember what the degrees of air raid warnings were. I think it was yellow, purple and red. In degrees of intensity. And we had a system that there was a telephone hut rigged up on the training area. And as soon as they got whatever was the first, I think it was yellow, you know, when there was a hint of a raid coming towards the northeast coast. Anyway, as soon as ARP headquarters or some control body on the east coast here got air raid warning yellow, message straight to our training area, and there was always a security officer appointed for that particular night training. Very light and all the lights out. And it worked every time, as far as I know. There may have been the odd occasion when there'd been bomb damage to telephone exchanges and so on. But there could have been potential raids that came to nothing, that were diverted further south, or had been stopped out at sea. But we weren't to know.
Were there any great difficulties in the training situation itself with this particular equipment for the crews? Was there anything which particularly was difficult for them?
Well, changing the arc lamps, the carbon rods in the arc lamp was a tricky sort of business with wearing thick asbestos gloves. And it didn't always get coordinated as a squadron commander might wish, that he's got probably two troops out of his squadron in action, lit up, and drivers and commanders learning to maintain the requisite overlap with his neighbour right and left. I think the priority was, it was like marching, it was by the left, so that each one had to keep pace so that his fan of light overlapped the one on his left and so on down the line. But in the early stages, there were occasions when the timing of certain ones changing of the carbon rods brought a nasty gap in the middle of it. That was a thing that it could only come by practice.
You mentioned something about night vision being causing problems.
Yes. We all had to be tested for night vision, and what that consisted of was in batches, going into a blacked out hut with a sort of light lock, as against airlock, entrance to it, and then wearing dark goggles to make sure for what? 20 minutes, half an hour before we're actually ushered in to take the test. And the test was a dimly lit screen, and it had a circle with north and south and east west lines crossing it, like a telescopic sight, and the lines went beyond the circle, and there was a moving pointer, and I hadn't a clue who conducted the tests. We never saw them actually, because the room, we went from the waiting room where we'd been sitting goggled into the test room, and one had to say whether the pointer was pointing north or northwest, this, that, and the other, and they eliminated the guesswork with some of them tried to guesswork when they couldn't see a damn thing, and they'd left it where it was the last time, you know, and having said, and where's it pointing now? Actually, they hadn't moved it, and somebody was a bit dodgy. Oh, that's northeast now, and there weren't a lot, but we had to transfer quite a number of men. One or two officers as well, I think. And we were classified as 10 over 10, perfect night vision. And I think it affected the trade classification of some of the other ranks. That Bodge had been down as drivers because obviously you weren't going to do an approach march with the CDL lights on. I mean, the drivers had to drive in darkness, probably with just a tail light or a light slung underneath of the tank ahead of him. It might even, in tricky ground, mean that the leading tank was lead and the others followed a telltale behind. So the drivers had to have good night vision. The tank commanders, quite obviously. For those who might switch from having been drivers, if they were pretty good but not perfect, if they were 7 out of 10, or rather than 10 out of 10, it might mean them switching trades. But, as I say, we did lose some men, but shortly afterwards, you see, not shortly afterwards, it's in 1943. I'll come to that later on, but we started getting intakes in from the training regiments. Most of them youngsters. Well, a little bit younger than the rest of us. That would be in 1943. Other aspects of training. At some stage during end of 42, maybe it's on end of 43, or maybe jumping the gun. I'll say a little bit more about the technical side of it. there was obviously no, it wasn't, it was a driving and an exercise range. It wasn't a field firing range. There was, we weren't able to practice gunnery. I should also say, and I cannot give you the proportion of one to the other, but of course we had gun tanks as well as CDL tanks, which could be put anywhere in the triangle of darkness between the two fans, I'll call them, of light.
As part of the training for the gun tanks to work with the CDLs.
And of course a good deal of training in wireless procedure. And also there were road if you can call them, marches with the tanks as well, to get used to the handling of.
Would you say that they came up to what was they were intended to do with these tanks, these lights?
Yes, and to emphasize that point, they certainly gave the intensity of light that we'd been told to expect on the training courses, in the lecture room. Nobody paced it out to see whether it was 1,000 yards and whether it was, 320 yards wide. But we're taken out in batches to the far end to look back at it and see what it looked like on the receiving end, both on a steady beam and on what we called a scatter beam with the 6 times a second shutter working.
What was the result of that? Did it blind you?
Well, you were pretty well dazzled with the steady beam. If a tank hit a bit of bad ground and went into a dip, and of course the light went into a dip too, then one's eyes tend to recover from the dazzle, and but it would have to be a hell of a big dip to go into to lose the effect of that beam, because quite probably in that case, again part of the training, then the ones on either side would probably speed up so their beams overlapped to cover up for the one who was missing in between. It was if that was difficult to try and maintain it if somebody hit bad ground, but it had to be practiced.
Would it, in your opinion, have been difficult for an enemy to fire back or fight back if they'd been hit with these beams?
Well, the other thing, still regarding ourselves as at the business end, whether on a steady beam or a scatter beam. There were two coloured filters, a blue one and a yellow one, I think. Oh, and don't ask me which was which, but one had the effect of giving the impression that the tanks were further away, and the other one, that the tanks were nearer than when it was on a white light beam. So everybody got a chance to see what it looked like from the business end.
So this was intended to bemuse an enemy.
Mm.
Did it work?
Well, we the brigadier got the King's Troop, the Royal Horse Artillery, onto the training ground, and they did exercises with us, and they did a bit got permission to do a bit of live firing, and. Their OP officer was in one of the cruiser tanks, whether it was Covenant or Crusade or whatever it was. And they had difficulty in ranging on the light. And I mean, they were crack artillery unit. The story was passed around that they had been asked to try shelling a squadron with live ammunition. But whether in fact it had happened, or whether somebody had got the wrong end of the stick of when they were firing ahead of us, I think it was probably the latter. Actually, the CO and I and somebody else, can't remember who else, when they did that firing practice, we were ahead of them. And we were taking cover behind one of the many Lake District stone walls, or should I say, about part of one of the few surviving stone walls at the time, with a wood at the back of us. And I suppose it was a bit foolhardy, because the shell fragments were pattering into the trees just above us. Later on, I wonder whether I should say this now, or I'll mention it and then elaborate on it later on. At some stage, and I think it was probably the spring of 43, I don't remember there being there any time when it was dark, there was a place, a manor house. They dilapidated, never been lived in for years, east of Penrith, and I can't for the life of me remember. I could go to it tomorrow, I could drive to it tomorrow, but I can't remember the name of it. But it was not lived in, or certainly the stable block and the outbuildings weren't lived in, and there was a huge upstairs loft over part of the stables. And it was made secure with window bars and a new door and fancy locks and so on. And I was at brigade headquarters, acting as the brigade IO, while he was away on a lengthy course. And this was where the other side of CDL came into it, because we used this place with an enormous cloth model. I didn't have to set it up. It was already set up by the brigade IO and the brigade commander and the brigade major. And there were regular meetings with all the COs and the second in commands and the squadron commanders and the squadron 2ICs, and it was a very big cloth model, and it had all sorts of terrain depicted on it, and this was where the tactics were worked out, and it was a protracted exercise that went on, and everybody had their say. I was responsible in the time I was there for leaving it just like a cloth model. It looked like anything that any ordinary tank unit might use. Probably a downside bigger, but and as I say, it was secure. But tanks, model tanks, and white fan-shaped card to simulate the CDL lights. And the tactical use of the weapon was worked out there, virtually by all the senior officers in the brigade, with Brigadier Lipscomb's own ideas put forward and commented upon, sometimes disagreed with, amended, tried out. And some of the moves then tried out on the ground to see whether what we'd worked out in theory was a practical possibility.
Did they work out an ideal terrain and ideal conditions under which to use it?
No, it was worked out, as I say, it was a big model, and it included, when I say built up areas, I'm not talking about cities, I'm talking about small towns, villages, and so on, and open country. Quite obviously, it wouldn't have been much good in the low countries. There'd been too many irrigation ditches and canals, which would be difficult obstacles. But ways of tackling a heavily defended village. Usually, if the ground permitted, the idea was try a flanking movement first in darkness, in line ahead, and then swing the turrets round and light up from a flank, and bring the gun tanks in with CDLs not lit on the other flank. And when they lit up, then the gun tanks shell the fortified, the defended village, and then switch out and light up this side, so that not only the light, but the alternate left and right hook with the light was going to be even more confusing. That was only one aspect. The ideal thing would be reasonable country for an approach march and an area where the tanks could be almost in drill formation to get that spread of light and the overlap to put the crocodiles, the flamethrowers, the RE's specialist equipment, right up in the point of the triangle of darkness between them.
Was it purely intended as an offensive weapon?
Oh, yes. Yes. Its basic premise was to allow tanks to fight by night. And until we got the grants, which had the hull gun, it was the gun tanks relying on the CDL tanks to light up the targets with them, and for the gun tanks by their fire indirectly giving protection to the CDL tanks. Got the best of both worlds with the grants and the Lees. But even with that, we still had Sherman gun tanks. I'll get on to that later on. I used to win many a bet with the grants when the driver's flap was open. It would be about 15 inches laterally by about a foot. When it was closed, of course, it he had his periscope. And I used to say, I used to demonstrate this, not just for a bet, although I won a few bets, that anybody of my stature could, in emergency, get out through the driver's visor. They wouldn't believe me at first, but mind you, I was only about 8 stone or something. I hadn't put on much more weight since I was coxing on the river in Durham before the war.
You started with Matildas.
Yep.
Where did you go to from those tanks?
When did we start changing over? Thinks. No, I need notice of that one. So we had the Matildas right up till August 43, you know, the best part of a year, by which time the fitters could handle them well, the ones that didn't get diesel dermatitis. That was a complication for the fitters. And then we went on to Grant's, Lee's, Sherman's in the late summer, well, from the August 43 on into the autumn.